You're listening to a podcast from West Hill United Church. These podcasts are made possible by the generous support of our listeners. To donate, click on the Canada Helps button or go to westhill.net/donate.
We are in the middle of our Academy Awards series looking at the movies that are nominated for Best Picture, and I want you to tear a piece off your little folder again today and give this movie, Silver Linings Playbook, if you've seen it, 1 to 10. You're not, remember, voting on my perspectives that I'm offering to you now, but you're voting on the movie. And then drop it in the bowl on the way out. We're going to tally those so that we'll see whether West Hill actually chooses the right movie. It'll be interesting to see how close we get. But we're looking at them, or I'm trying to bring to them, the idea about conversation, about communications, looking at the ways that each of these different movies challenges our understanding of communication in a different way and invites us to look at ourselves and the way that we practice communication and how we might do it a little bit better. I've been using predominantly a book by some Harvard professors who are part of Harvard's world-renowned mediation program, who wrote the book Difficult Conversations. And I'm going to reiterate each week the kinds of conversations that we're having when we're having a difficult conversation. Because it's not just what's going on at the level of words flying back and forth at each other, and we're arguing about where to kennel the dog. We don't have a dog, so that's one argument we have not had recently. But where to kennel the dog. We're not talking about where to kennel the dog. We're talking about a number of things. And there's three arguments going on that these authors have placed before us and invited us to look at. The first one is the argument about what happened. And it has three components itself, because as we're looking to find out what got us in this situation to begin with, why are we fighting about this, we have to recognize that there are three parts of it. One is that I walk into that argument knowing, of course, that I have everything right. My perspective is perfect. I have all the facts that anyone would ever need to enter that argument. And I will lay them out for you, and it's your job to pick them up and go, oh, honey, I'm sorry, I didn't realize, and carry on, and everything would be smooth. After that, we wouldn't be having an argument. But the fact is that the truth is not held by any one person. There are nuances of it all over the place, and as our partners are wont to remind us, they have their own opinion about what it might be, and they're expecting you to just pick it up and say, oh, thank you, honey, I didn't know. Never happens. Never happens. At least I'm not familiar with it ever happening. So we have to be aware that truth is nuanced, and as we're having the conversation about what really happened, being open to hearing what other people saw happening at the same time is extremely helpful. The next one in this what happened is a suggestion that someone intended a certain thing. We assume that someone is intending something. You're intending to get rid of the dog by taking it to that kennel. I know why you want to go to that kennel, because the dog will never come home from that kennel. That's why. I know what your intent is. In fact, I don't know what someone's intent is unless they actually share it with me. So they're not going to share it with me, are they, if I just assume I know what it is and don't ask them what their intentions were. So the conversation about what your intentions were in making that choice, it becomes important. The next one is blame, the blame game, and we play that regularly, where we know that someone was at fault, and so we clearly are looking throughout the entire conversation, whether it's a conversation with two people or a conversation with a dozen, we're looking for the person who actually made the problem happen to begin with. And once we've found that person, then we can feel better. But in actual fact, it's a contribution to the situation that we should be looking for. The authors have noted that blame is never really ever found on one single person. There's a contribution to the events that unfold around us, and our seeking out our own part in that is a good part of that. Now, the other two conversations that are taking part at the same time that multifaceted one is happening are the conversations about our feelings. What is it that we are feeling when we enter into these conversations? Are we angry? Are we sad? Are we feeling vulnerable? What is it that we are experiencing as we go into these conversations? And exposing that, allowing ourselves to open ourselves up to what the other person is feeling too, leads to a very different conversation. And the final one is the conversation about identity, which is also taking place. Who am I as I have this conversation? If I let you take the dog to that kennel, what does that say about me as a person? Does it mean that I'm weak, that I will give in to your perspective? Does it mean that I don't care about the dog? Does that make me a bad person because we've had this dog for ages and now I'm letting you do whatever you want? The conversation is often about our identity, and it's also about the other person's identity. They're having the same conversation in their head. Feeling that, understanding that, and perhaps exploring it with a person all helps. So this is the groundwork that we have brought to the exploration of these movies. So now I'm going to ask for the trailer for Silver Linings Playbook to be played. Okay, how many of you believe in Silver Linings? I mean, how many of you believe that in any situation you can find a silver lining? That's pretty good. I think I'm with the rest of you, but finding a silver lining is the story in the playbook thing. One of the reviewers was not happy with the title of this movie, though he was happy with everything else, but thought that the title was a bit too hard to say. So Silver Lining Playbooks is maybe a little hard to say, but the story itself unfolds with such a sense of reality. It feels so honest and real that you're captivated by it and the way it unfolds from the first moment till the end. It's a great movie to get up close to what people are experiencing and how conversations take place. One of the things about the conversations in this movie that I particularly liked was that they seemed real because people talk over top of each other all the time. It's a real conversation taking place. It's not staged in, I'll say this, and then you read your line. It's just happening the way it happens in our households, in our homes. And it's interesting to watch how some of those things happen in that movie and then reflect upon how they happen in our own lives. I want to start, though, by talking about those letters that we write, often not to mail, but the letters that we write to deal with our experiences of someone, perhaps in our family, that maybe a therapist has suggested you should do in order to get your feelings out on paper. And they often suggest that you don't actually mail the letter, but that you do write it. Now, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands for how many of you have actually written letters like that, and I'm really not going to ask for a show of hands as to how many have actually received a letter like that. Yeah, interesting stuff. But what I want you to think about is the difference between two letters that you would write. The letter that you would write that was never intended to be mailed, and the letter that you would write if you knew it was going to be mailed. Because I think that even with the support of the best therapists, there would still be a difference between those two letters. That you would still hold back a little bit and perhaps not say as much as what you feel or the way you see things, the way you believe things unfolded, the timeline drawn out, that we would hold back a little bit on sharing that completely with people that we love enough to write these letters to them. That the letter that we wrote that we never intended to mail, while it might get all of our feelings of anger and anxiety and our sense of justice out onto paper, it would not be the one that we would mail. It would pour out more ragged truth, more reality than we would care to put in the other letter. I believe it was when Robertson Davies died, he was being interviewed on the, he wasn't being interviewed, he was dead. His biographer was being being interviewed on CBC, and the host of the show said, "So I noticed that his writings changed around a certain date. What happened there that he really changed the way he wrote?" And the biographer said, "People died." When we are in a continuing relationship with people, we tend to temper those relationships and not be as honest as we might be. Not be as honest as may lead to the breakdown of relationship or potentially the healing of relationship. It's only perhaps when people die that we will have the true conversation with others around them that we would have held back on. When the letters were they set side by side to one another, we might find that in the letter that doesn't get mailed, there's a lot of constructive stuff that were we able to figure out how to put it in the first letter, we might actually be able to fit it in there. And I think that the guidelines that we've been given through the Difficult Conversations book, if you made a chart and put those different conversations that you needed to have and let them guide that letter, that you might actually be able to squeeze all the real truth into it without risking the relationship entirely. And that's just an opportunity for you to explore at a later date. But what's happening on the screen in Silver Linings Playbook is that conversation that you would never mail. It's the conversation that happens when people have no filters at all. They just say what comes out, what happens to pop into their mind. And you see it even on the trailer when he says, "We don't have to talk about that." How many were there? It comes out immediately. There's no filter on these people because of the things that are happening within their minds and according to their illness. Now, we understand that Pat has a bipolar disorder. Tiffany is never actually diagnosed, though some suggest that maybe it's a borderline personality disorder that she's struggling with. They both have been on the same variety of medications with the same side effects and chosen at certain times to rid themselves of medication at all, thereby taking whatever filter the medication may have offered them completely out of the story as well. But around them, despite their being identified as crazy people, around them, the families in which they function are also pretty crazy. Pat's family, his father, has probably an obsessive-compulsive disorder, is running a booking thing out of his living room, has all kinds of superstitions about exactly who needs to be where and what needs to be touched in order to make things happen exactly as they're supposed to happen. Do you think he's right? Do you think that works out for him? I think he does pretty well. I really do think he does pretty well. His mother supports and cringes as she watches her husband go through life, making these decisions that upon which the family's fortunes rest. His brother is functioning, competent, professional, who blurts out a variety of totally inappropriate things when he first sees Pat after a long period of time. It's as though there's not a single relationship in that family that could be seen to be healthy or appropriate, that isn't tainted or touched in some way by mental illness. And one of the reviewers said that they think that the movie is about finding a happy ending. In order to find a happy ending, you have to find someone who can actually live with your madness instead of someone who's going to guide you out of it. As long as you're looking for someone who's going to guide you out of it, the happy ending can't happen. It's about people finding someone who sort of understand that craziness and go with it, and that's certainly what we see in the movie. But the parts that are particularly tragic in the movie are those moments that Deb described from the reading, in the reading that she shared with us. The moments when it goes from that assurance that getting himself healthy, eating the right foods, reading the right books, and having a positive attitude, when they're not enough, when he goes from that going with the flow and everything going with them to that against the grain that it spoke of in that reading. And how when that happens, the ability to hold on to reality fractures and is often responded to with anger and violence. And there's one scene in the movie where a very small misunderstanding between Pat and his father leads to an argument which escalates and becomes violent and is tragic in its reality as it plays itself out on the screen. When Scott and I saw the movie, and it's a hysterical movie, there are a lot of very, very funny parts in it. They've wrapped that beautifully together in the package. But when we saw the movie, the whole theater was laughing during that very tragic exchange, an exchange that's all too true in some of our lives and that many of us have watched others cope with. So the question is, what can we learn from this kind of conversation, this filterless conversation that brings two people who lack filters together to care for one another, to see beyond the craziness or perhaps deep into the craziness in ways that bind them together with a deep and beautiful love that we watch grow on that screen? What is it that we can learn from that depth of madness that we see playing itself out on the film, both the madness that is experienced by Pat and that of Tiffany and those around them? Tiffany's sister and her husband are in this wild relationship in which neither of them share their truths with the other one to any extent whatsoever. What is it that we can learn about that? The opening quote, which Deb reiterated, "I opened myself to you and you judged me," I think is a huge part of what we can learn from this movie, that one single line. We don't mail the letter because we don't want to be judged. We don't tell someone the truth about our relationship with them because we don't want to be judged. We don't honor our own integrity because we don't want to be judged. How do we get beyond that place of judgment or the fear of that judgment in order that we can be open to one another? I don't think we have to be mad to do that. I don't think we have to be bipolar. I don't think we have to be manic. I don't think we have to live in a crazy household in order to blurt those things out. But we do have to manage and be intentional about who we are and how we share ourselves with others. And I'm not sure that we consider those things on a day-to-day basis. In fact, when we go through life with attentiveness to the long lists of things that we all have to do, the responsibilities, the roles, the different things that we have to fit into this puzzle that is the, you know, 16 waking hours of our day, I think that we probably very rarely stop and think about our integrity, about how we are held together in a whole, about what pieces have slipped somewhere else because we haven't wanted to honor them. We felt risk about honoring them, and so we hide them away. We don't open ourselves to one another. No one really wants all their truths out there for everyone to judge. No one wants to be open to everyone. But I think it's essential that we find a way to be open in relationship with one or two or six people that can know us for who we are. On the way to that, however, we find these incredible enigma machines. The code changes, sometimes it seems every day, as it did during the Second World War. But more often than not, it's the same code that we've had since we were children. The same code that we learned as children, that we integrated in order to survive in the households of madness in which we grew up. And I would be willing to bet that even, perhaps especially, if you told me your house was perfect, there was something dysfunctional about it. We all, as children, grow up seeing and experiencing a world for which we have no intellectual structure upon which to hang it. So everything at some point in time as we are developing is utterly nuts. If we can't explain it and put it into that structure somehow, it's just weird. And so we as children, even in perfect families, we integrate things with glitches in them, with misunderstandings, with misunderstandings about what our experiences are, misdefinitions. We don't define things appropriately. And the problem is that as we grow, it never occurs to us to go back and say, you know that thing you did when I was three? Were you doing this? To which your parent or sibling might say, oh my goodness, are you serious? You thought that's what that was about? No, it's not about... That happens in our day-to-day now. Imagine what happened when we were pre-verbal or when our skills at discerning what's going on in relationships were non-existent. As children, we create our codes. They're developed for us by the people around us, and we integrate them into who we are, and they become an enigma for every other person we ever meet. There's a code that has to be taken apart, broken by the other person in order for us to really, truly communicate. And I would be willing to bet that on a day-to-day basis, that doesn't even occur to us. We don't think about the enigmas that we have going on inside us. That makes it impossible for us to truly share who we are. And so in that sharing of who we are, be open and welcoming of whatever judgment may come. Because if we were operating without that code and we opened ourselves to someone else, their judgment would be accurate. If theirs was open too, because we'd be able to have a free-flowing conversation that reflected truth, that honored our feelings, that displayed the history around us to one another. So as we move through the process of communication with one another, I think the lesson that we can learn from Tiffany and Pat and maybe those around them who also get it, is that we must find our way to opening ourselves to one another, to being comfortable with the realities that our expressiveness, our ways of communicating, are coded by our childhoods and everything that has happened to us since. And that if we are intentional about decoding that, about understanding who we are, and if we are intentional about helping the person with whom we are in communication decode theirs as well, recognizing you may absolutely not be the person who will ever be able to do that, but knowing that that person has a coded way of speaking as well, experiences that are hardwired in them now because those tracks have been followed over and over and over again. And while it may make something difficult for you to understand, it makes perfect sense to them. If we can recognize that we each have those enigma machines within us, filtering everything that we say, then perhaps we'll find the courage to meet in the middle and talk about what decoding that might look like. And then when we know the code, helping one another remember it as we go about our day today. At the very end of the movie, and this is you can plug your ears, this is, what's it called when they... Spoiler alert. Plug your ears. Pat, who has been trying to get his wife back throughout the entire movie, sees her in one of the final scenes. And he goes up to her and he just whispers in her ear. And you don't know what he says. You have no way of knowing what he says. But whatever it is, it opens him and gives him permission to move into the rest of his life. Whether it's one of the most beautiful and mature goodbyes ever offered, whether it was something about the football game that had just finished, whether it was, I don't know, whatever it was, leave it to your imagination. It let him into the rest of his life. We don't get to just tell somebody something and move into the rest of our lives. But we do have to have conversations. And when we do them well, it can lead to the rest of your lives in a way that is extraordinary and clean and good and full. Look for the places that those can happen, and then find your way to them with your integrity intact, with an understanding of who you are, and an openness to who that other person is. And then be present as what unfolds.